Musical talents as to say that I learned during those years quite a lot about musicians and what they're up against and what they tend to say sometimes and by themselves about the clergy. So I've always kept that in mind and meeting with people, and you know, I think it's gone very well. Now, I've got really just two things to say today. Somewhat elaborate mode, perhaps. But first of all, I want to get across the message that you all believe in, but we have trouble sometimes considering what we're up against, that music is important. It's not a more or less dispensable extra that can be thrown in when you feel like it, or cover the gaps, as I'm about to say in a few minutes. And I want to encourage you to believe that decent music is indispensable for decent Catholic liturgy. Start forgetting about the quality of the music, and then you just look and see what you get, liturgically speaking. So I want to encourage you, but you're here today because you believe it. I want to encourage you to try to maintain the truth in practice in often very trying circumstances. I know that the church needs, of course you need the church for the living and all that, but the church needs you badly because you forget about beauty and truth and goodness become more and more unattractive. So, that is really what I want to say. It's important, and you must lose courage, and that you're working not just for yourselves, but you're working for the good of the whole church. Because otherwise, the clergy are going to end up talking to them about themselves. And that's not who they're supposed to talk to. They're supposed to talk to the world. So then, let me say something in more detail about what I'm going to be talking about. First of all, about the nature of my talk. You're not about to hear a manifesto as how we might reform the liturgy of the church, as well as my ideas for a happier and more productive relationship between musicians and clergy, topped off perhaps with encouraging voices about the future. I have no altogether, apart from the evidence of your own experience, one has only to read the Chat Cafe, I think that's an organization, in preparation for these 2 weeks of meetings in Pittsburgh, to realize that no sensible man would undertake such a task. In 1977, Monsignor Schuller wrote that in every area a regression has occurred. Performance, composition, education. Deep theological controversies surfaced early after the council and soon became apparent in liturgical music, a fact that brought conflicts growing out of the council into the focus of most faithful, producing many doubts and worries. I don't suppose anyone's going to disagree about that. Well, we cannot think he would have written very differently today, although as the Chat Cafe suggests, perhaps the CMAA has gotten a little louder and more well known, but as the Chat Cafe goes on to add, in what must be the understatement of the year, the task is far from over. So what am I going to do? Fundamentally, I want to draw back from the world of horror stories. I want to try to forget for a few minutes the world of indifferent clergy, impossible liturgical committees and depressing budgetary constraints. Furthermore, as I've already suggested, I'm not going to lay down some utopian solution as to what must be done. I don't know. Except for some certain things I can say. So my intention then in my talk is to outline some of the machines. So my intention then in my talk, thank you very much, that made a big difference, is to outline some of the factors which have led to the present messy situation. I have little to say for your immediate comfort. On the other hand, seeing the present situation as it really is, how it developed, may help us to discern how we can prevent it from getting worse. Maybe, even, our quick look at the past may lead to some small amelioration of our present plight. Maybe. In this task of seeing where we are now and how we got there, I'm going to begin with a very broad description of some of Plato's views about the importance of music in general, of art in general, and music in particular. I will really be doing little more than to restate the Catholic view that art and music matter. It's not just a theory musicians have. They matter, art and music, because although the truth can be expressed in many different modalities, music and art are not only an indispensable avenue to the God who took upon himself the form of a servant and was found in the likeness of men, but also, and perhaps we don't pay enough attention to this, also and importantly, equally importantly, the way that same God approaches us. Music's necessary for us to get to God, and music's one of the ways that God approaches us. Having laid this foundation, I will then talk about two things. Please, don't want to be here all night. Anyways, first of all, what we may call the classical view of the liturgy and the place of music in such an act of worship. Then I want to deal with the breakdown of the philosophical underpinnings of this view. And this breakdown can be said to have been firmly in place, at least in philosophical and literary circles, by the beginning of the 19th century. Finally, I will describe what is called the postmodern situation, which we all inhabit, and that is the de facto abandonment of the traditional view of art and liturgy. They say you bear with you for life, your deformation professionnelle, your professional deformation. Well, I spent most of my life, amongst other things, at least earning what money I've ever earned, teaching philosophy, so I mean, I'm sorry if it comes through too much. Anyway, so let's start with a brief look at Plato. In her Romanus Lectures of 1976, entitled The Fire of the Sun, Iris Murdoch gave a subtitle, Why Plato Banished the Artists. Why Plato Banished the Artists. And in an engaging way, open only to those of great eminence and imperturbable self-confidence, she opens her lectures by contradicting herself. To begin with, of course, Plato did not banish all the artists, or always suggest banishing any. But anyway, she gets our attention. She was an outstanding artist herself, in words, in addition to being a brilliant philosopher. And with this apparent self-contradiction, she skillfully draws our attention to the important and very puzzling fact that those who understand best the impact of art and of music, that often those very same people are the most ambivalent about this place in society, and therefore obviously the church too. Plato talks about banishing the artist from the ideal commonwealth, at least he sometimes talks that way, not because he was aesthetically blind, but because he understood, probably firsthand, the dreadful havoc caused by art gone wrong. And rather than condemning out of hand those who worry about the influence of art, we might well ask, with Iris Murdoch, the not uninteresting question whether Plato may not have been in some ways right to be so suspicious of art. In the end, Plato wanted art to be carefully controlled, not because he thought it was unimportant, but because he thought it was important enough and powerful enough to distract man from the pursuit of what was good and true. Got in the way of our destiny. Now, Plato thought that poets mislead us by portraying the gods as undignified. They lead us to pictures of the gods laughing. They also, as writers of children's stories, don't encourage children to respect religion or to admire good people or to see that crime does not pay. I don't think that sounds familiar to you, but not to what Plato said first. Music and the theater should encourage stoical calmness, not boisterous, uncontrolled emotion. We are infected by playing or enjoying a bad role in the theater. Art can do cumulative psychological harm in this way. Now, Plato's lifelong engagement with the place of art in society and with its role in education, with its connection to half-hidden and mysterious archetypes, archetypes which massively qualify the consciousness of all, goes a long way to justify the remark of the English-American philosopher A.N. Whitehead that the history of philosophy is little more than footnotes to Plato. However, we're not here to probe superficially into the history of philosophy for its own sake, interesting as I might find it. On the other hand, ideas that endure seem to begin their lives as elements in the work of the philosophers. Gradually, these ideas become absorbed into the broader culture of an age and often end up by having very practical and easily observable consequences. And that's surely the case with the work of Plato. Plato, that is, first articulated and so draw attention to a series of questions or subject matters or topics which still face us today, which still face you, when we think about the place of art and music in society. And that's not to maintain that everything he said was right, or everything he said was true, in all respects for all time. Tis, however, to make the claim that his articulation of these questions, these problems, still matters. And what he taught in answer to those questions is so important that it can't be ignored. And we all live with the consequences of the people's interpretation of what he said. Furthermore, even when we're pretty sure he didn't get everything quite right, the effort to find out how and why he went wrong will itself bring us closer to a deeper understanding of the role of the artist in society, and that's what you are. What is more to the point, perhaps for us, to a more assured grasp of the part music should play in the liturgy of the Catholic Church. Plato was one of those who believed, and I believe quite rightly, that we cannot discuss the good life for man in isolation from other human beings. In other words, to try to understand ethics or the way we should live, the best way of living, in isolation from the life of some sort of community or society
is a dead end. And in his great work, Republic, he investigates such a community or a society by setting himself two different and closely related tasks. First of all, he looks at a description of what a just society in the abstract would be like. And then secondly, he searches out a way of portraying that just society, a way of portraying which will reveal the abstract description not as a baseless dream, but as a possible framework with which man's actual real nature, with its unalterable claims, might find well-being and happiness. Paint a beautiful picture, but there's no hope of being realized. There's not much point doing it unless you like painting pictures. Well, he thought that he painted a picture of an ideal society, but he thought it was, in fact, realizable. So, one of the functions of the ideal state is the education of individuals to play different roles when they become adults. Some will be rulers, some will be warriors, and others will be crafts. Education in a broad sense, or of the whole man, thus assumes a central role for Plato. And education in this broad sense is much more than book learning. It is concerned with the development of character. The ultimate end or purpose of education is insight. Insight into the harmonious order of the whole world and the formation of each individual of a similar balance between different aspects of his nature and building it into a kind of harmonious whole. And central, Plato's view, I hope in ours too, is central to this perception of order and the reproduction of this order in the individual, which is what education is about, is training in music. The decisive importance of education in poetry and music is that rhythm and music sink deep into the recesses of the soul and take the strongest hold there, bringing that grace of body and mind which is only to be found in one who has been brought up in the right way. Now, the young person, fortunate enough to be brought up in this right way through good music, will, Plato goes on to say, approve all that is lovely and will welcome it home with joy into his soul and, nourished thereby, grow to a man of a noble spirit. That's what good training in music does. Or should I say training in good music? Surely we have here a foreshadowing of St. Paul's exhortation that whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is lovely, whatever is good report, think about these things. But St. Paul continues in just the way Plato intends, don't just think about them, but what you have learned, received, and heard from me, do. That is, reproduce that loveliness in your own development and in what you yourselves do. Training in what is beautiful, then, influences us to become more like the God we are supposed to worship, I'm told, in the beauty of holiness. Moreover, a proper training of this kind makes a man quick to perceive any defect or ugliness in art or in nature. All that is ugly and disgraceful, Plato says, he will rightly condemn and abhor while he is still too young to understand the reason. But when reason comes, he will greet her as a friend with whom his education has made him long familiar. So Plato's claim is this. Our exposure to what is good and lovely helps to form us into better human beings, while being drenched in ugliness develops and exacerbates all the forces in our nature which lead to disorder, disorder and immorality. Why then did Plato ban the artists, or sometimes? Well, because although Plato gave beauty a crucial role in his philosophy, he didn't have too much time for artists. He constantly accuses artists of moral weakness and even baseness. Iris Murdoch describes Plato's attitude like this. Artists are interested in what is base and complex, not in what is simple and good. They induce the better part of the soul to relax its guard. Thus, images of wickedness and excess may lead even good people to indulge secretly through art feelings which they would be ashamed to entertain in their life. We enjoy cruel jokes and bad taste in the theater, and then behave boorishly at home. Art both expresses and gratifies the lowest part of the soul and feeds and enlivens base emotions which ought to be left to wither. So, art is important and has a vital play along with music in a proper education. And that role is to help build up a harmonious balance between the different elements of human nature. Plato calls that harmonious balance temperance. Temperance doesn't mean total abstinence, but points to the ideal of an integrated human nature. And such an integrated human nature will be a fit instrument to pursue whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is lovely, whatever is gracious, whatever is of good report. On the other hand, music is dangerous because it can be, and often is, used to upset the harmonious balance of the different elements of our nature. In a way, it leads to ugliness, immorality, and a complete loss of any sense of direction towards good. Art is important, but art is dangerous. That would seem to be one way of summing up Plato's message, and I think what he says is right. But if this is the case, then it's not surprising that Christianity, having grown out of Judaism, should find its relation to art and artistic production to be a complex one. And it still finds its relation to art and artistic production to be a complex one. And of course, the tradition itself has undergone great development over the centuries. But leaving that aside, I think that one has to hold on to the fact that the Jews, when they are said to have prohibited the making of images, well, it's clear, I should have said, I mean, it's right in Exodus, thou shalt not make unto thyself any image. But that activity itself, somehow of imaging, both by sight and by sound, the truths of faith, is something that haunts the Christian consciousness. And it was also the influence art had to strengthen the tendency towards sorts of bad behavior. The pagan background, not to speak of related sexual overtones of ancient art, helped to explain a morally and religiously based ambivalence about beauty among the fathers. Indeed, from time to time throughout the history of Christianity, preachers have sought to dismiss earthly beauty as at best irrelevant to religion, and at worst, a source of irreligion
and immorality, which is Plato, ill, it often is. So the profound ambivalence that you all find sometimes amongst the clergy, it is not something new. And what I find on the whole is reprehensible. It's easily explicable in causal terms because of the history of Christians and Jews towards images. But this is what people don't seem to grasp. The doubts and hesitations about earthly beauty, in spite of that, the church finally came down firmly on the side of the representation of holy things. The incarnation had revealed God in human form, and therefore, in spite of whatever dangers there might be, it must be not only lawful, but also helpful to represent the divine in images, to represent the divine in images. St. John Damascene argued that previously God, who had neither body nor face, absolutely could not be represented by an image. But now that he has made himself visible in the flesh and lived with men, I can make an image of what I have seen of God and contemplate the glory of the Lord, his face unveiled. Now this sort of image and its argument and its conclusion were affirmed in 787 at the Second Council of Nicaea. It's Catholic doctrine now. And the rejection of iconoclasm has justifiably been called a decision of incalculable significance. Art, I'm skipping a bit because I've been on too long. Art is important, but art is dangerous. Art is important because it is an integral part of the incarnational aspect of Catholic Christianity. To repeat what St. John Damascene said, he has made himself visible in the flesh and dwelt with man, and I can make an image of what I've seen of God. Art of any sort, and certainly a fortiori, this includes music, art is an activity of our human nature, and it is one of the ways we are led to approach God, and to contemplate that God who, for our salvation, took upon himself that same human nature that you and I might be saved. As musicians, you must hold on to that truth. The role of music in the liturgy cannot be reduced to the essentially unimportant function of filling in the gaps or providing free entertainment on Sunday morning. You all know what I mean. On this filling in the gaps view, music is a way of covering awkward moments of silence. Say, when the priest is moving from the altar to where he's going to preach, or to provide light relief against the pain of giving something in the offertory. Or to cover the racket the children may make as they are being led away in the middle of the Mass to the church hall to receive the instruction deemed fit for their tender years. The added bonus of free entertainment is sometimes provided because if you happen to like music, then you may, with good management, hear some music in church. You would have to pay a good deal of money to hear in the concert hall. Is that all there is to it? But if the role of music in liturgy is something more than filling in the gaps or entertaining the semi-religious, then how are we to understand, at least ideally, its true function? And any answer to that question will have to make at least a passing reference not only to music, but to liturgical music, worship itself. And that's, of course, a very tall order, especially right after lunch. But it's a tall order also because it's almost impossible to say anything about liturgy nowadays that would be accepted by everyone, And that's an important aspect of the situation we all face, not only musicians, you know, but a lot of priests as well. First of all, then, we have to deal with what I want to call the classical view of liturgy and the place of music in that liturgy. And one way of approaching that enormous subject would be to recall that one of the terms used to be employed about liturgy, the liturgy of the church, was ars celebrandi, the art of celebrating. The beauty of the liturgy is an ordered beauty. And the phrase ars celebrandi, the art of celebrating, refers to how the Mass and the other sacraments are to be celebrated in an ordered fashion. The use of the word art in this connection is important and requires some comment, because you mustn't get it all mixed up with what they call fine art nowadays. First of all, then, it has little to do, ars, in the sense of ars celebrandi, little to do with what is discussed nowadays under the heading of aesthetics. Ars in ancient Latin, like techne in Greek, meant a craft, or a specialization, or a skill that involved doing things, like building ships, or shearing horses, or surgery, or playing the lyre. L-Y-R-E. Art, Aristotle said, is the disposition by which we make things. Art is the disposition by which we make things according to a true rule. Now that conception, I think, is almost totally foreign to our way of thinking, and it was challenged even by the early Middle Ages. But by the time of the Renaissance, first in Italy and then elsewhere, the old meaning was reestablished, and Renaissance performers, like those of the ancient world, did actually think of themselves as craftsmen. They gloried in. The older view maintained that art is focused on the skilled accomplishment of what must be done. Music performance, on this view of things, is not concerned in any primary sense anyway with theory. What is it connected with? It's occupied, it's devoted to making an object, a something to be done, an object to be made, and is bound fast by rules. You can't build ships, you can't practice surgery, you can't shoe horses without rules. And the schoolmen following Aristotle affirmed this constantly, and they made this possession of fixed rules an essential property of ours or technique. Not that the object made or the activity produced by an activity such as liturgy suddenly acquires an occult quality called beauty. I'm beginning to bore. However, but to use Plato's words, it becomes admirable, excellent, or desirable. In some, as Plato held, this is felt to be attractive. You want it. The activity pulls us to itself, and in doing so points beyond itself to the mystery of the beauty of the holiness of God. It's not to say that liturgy is only the production of something beautiful. It is, however, most definitely to say that music, when, and liturgy, and music which accompanies it and strengthened it. Liturgy and music accompany the liturgy. It's to say that if the liturgy and the music are not beautiful, then the liturgy has ceased to be ars celebrandi, it's become something like the, I just made this word up this morning, sopo forendi, it becomes the art of boring people. Putting them to sleep. And you know, it's said that the church that is going to be, we in North America aren't aware enough about persecution, you know, and of course it's true when we think about awful things that are on in Syria, but on the other hand, I sometimes think the church is going to be emptied by boredom more than anything else. So I'm well aware, as I hinted above, that this view of performance of music and the liturgy as a thing to be done with rules which both help in their execution and in judging themselves is out of faith. Still, couldn't you and I at least take this from such a view, that hard work, expertise, skill, and professionalism are essential to both the liturgy itself as well as to the performance of the music, which is to support and even enhance that act of worship? You can't do much about the doing of the liturgy, but you can do a lot about the other part. No amount of sincerity, no amount of tender religious feelings, no amount of openness to the concerns of the modern world, no amount of distress at the plight of refugee people in the Middle East, none of that is going to make up for bad peddling in the St. Anne feud. You play E natural, it's not E flat. In our school, a little girl was asked how much time she spent practicing between her violin lessons. She said, "Oh, I never practice." When asked why, she said, "I'm just talented, I guess." I couldn't make that up, so I didn't make that up. "I'm just talented, I guess." Well, she was young, but that appalling attitude seems to be held by people a good deal older than she was. Church musicians expect, and quite properly expect, to be treated as professionals, and "I'm just talented, I guess," is not sufficient ground for a church musician to earn the right to be treated as a professional. And you know, that's true even if you don't think the other actors in liturgy are quite up to the mark. Leave you to spell that out. Now, then, and I promise you this is the last section, and I think it will be finished before an hour. Well, not quite, okay. Now, the breakdown of the classical view. If the liturgy is not a doing of a particular kind with fixed rules, it becomes the vehicle for the individual ideas of the celebrant or the liturgical committee of the moment. Liturgy is no longer something to be done, something to be done with clear rules of how to do it, something to be done as well as it can be done. Instead of this, what we might call this objective approach, liturgy has developed into a tool for getting across the personal slant on Christianity in those in charge of a particular celebration. It's because so many Catholics have at least tacitly accepted this mistaken view that rule-prescribed externals in religion do not really matter, we don't want any Pharisees here, or even harmful, that they feel that the whole question of beauty is irrelevant to the practice of sincere religion. And that's what you're up against. Not that they think you're wrong, you don't matter. Hegel called religion picture thinking, or being sunk in images. And this disdain for the external is closely related to the rejection of rule-based worship. And this disdain for rule-based worship, that goes hand in hand with the view that what is required for liturgy is not action in accordance with rules. What's required is being sincere. Sincere speech. yak, yak, yak. For this reason, Catholics are all too often faith that a deity becomes preferred, a style of worship that is almost exclusively verbal. Now, where does that leave musicians? Well, I don't have to ask you. I don't have to tell you. You don't know. It is on account of this morass and mistaken attitudes that we have been delivered into the hands of the new iconoclasts. Now, I'm going to skip here. I had some more to say about that, but I want to end up with a little section, final section, saying that beauty matters. And why beauty matters for us all is because it matters for the very preservation of the faith in the modern world. The ideology that has created the modern world has ended with an approach to things that is often called postmodernism. Postmodernism may be summed up as the attitude that one set of opinions is as good as another set, and this is so because there is no objectivity to be found in human experience. The very possibility of looking for a description of the way things really are is looked on as foolish, unsophisticated. That's your choice, and so long as you don't try and impose it on anyone else, you're perfectly well entitled to it. That sums up this attitude. There are no what the French call grande discours or general descriptions of reality, because to put it bluntly, there is no one reality to be described. Well, I mean, whether anybody's capable of believing that or not, they're certainly capable of saying it. And what I would want to maintain is that beauty matters in any context. And because it matters, then a liturgy that is beautiful also matters. And the question is not peripheral to life or merely aesthetic. That's your thing. You're living by it. Okay, that's fine. So what? So nothing. The crucial point is that the aesthetic is an essential dimension of reality. And what makes it essential is that the aesthetic has the capacity to point beyond itself in a way that cannot be reduced to questions of either truth or morality. Beauty matters. It cannot be reduced to more or less desirable extra. It is this vital importance of beauty that the great modern theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar set out to explain, to vindicate, to him in his great work, The Glory of the Lord. Everybody talks about that book. I think it would be a good thing if we tried to put some of the things he said into practice. Because if we don't return or begin to return to some sense of the importance of beauty, we're going to lose any real contact with what is good. And we will probably end up by not being able to love anything other than our own pleasure and particular power trips. The good and the true in the modern world, left to themselves without something to pull us towards them, are unattractive. Put yourself in some kind of enthusiasm about some kind of principle of good, think that the world's going to save by reading one page of encyclicals. I don't have nothing against the encyclicals or anything else. The thing is, why? Why? What's drawing you to it? And the following well-known words of von Balthasar are true even if their truth has become obscured by endless repetition. Beauty is the disinterested one, without which the ancient world refused to understand itself, a world which both imperceptibly and yet unmistakably, that's our world now, has bid farewell to our new world, a world of interests leading it to its own avarice and sadness. because we've ceased to be concerned with what is lovely, we've been reduced to a world with sadness, which is a world of interest, what we want, and of avarice and sadness. So the effect of banishment of the importance of beauty from the modern consciousness has a result that morality, in whatever form it is presented to us, appears as something imposed and alien to our real needs and desires. It comes across as duty for duty's sake, and no one's very interested in that really, except the clergy in the professional mode. And it's not surprising that wrongdoing seems a perfectly rational and indeed acceptable notion, personally respectable choice or option. In a world without beauty, even if people cannot dispense with the word, in a world which is perhaps not wholly without beauty, but which can no longer see it or reckon with it, in such a world, the good also loses its attractiveness, the self-evidence of why it must be carried out. Man stands before the good and asks himself, why should I do it? Why should I not do its alternative evil? Nor does the church take beauty very seriously anymore, and that's the whole trouble. Because of this, what the church says both about truth and goodness becomes more and more meaningless and irrelevant to the modern world. I'm not saying that what they say is wrong, I'm saying that because it's left to itself, it appears foreign and alien and unattractive. No longer loved or fostered by religion, beauty is lifted from its face, the face of religion, as a mask. Its absence exposes features that threaten to become incomprehensible to men. Von Balthasar is not arguing that concern for the beautiful ought to take the place of the truly good. To be concerned with the ascetic dimension of religion is not a substitute for either holiness or right belief. But what he's trying to get across to us, what he's arguing for, is that we will never be able, in the present modern world, to hold on either to the truth, to hold on to the truth and goodness of faith, and certainly not going to interest other people, or people who want to ourselves to interest other people. If we go on treating beauty as an irrelevant and basically frivolous concern, concern of those who are unable to cope with the real world without the rose-tinted spectacles of the ascetic, then we're finished. And why? Because beauty will, in von Balthasar's words, not allow herself to be separated and banned from her two sisters without taking along with herself as an act of mysterious vengeance, without taking them. Forget about beauty, and then truth and goodness are not going to be able to stand on their own feet. We can be sure that whoever sneers at her name of beauty, as if she were the ornament of the bourgeois past, have heard that, whether he admits it or not, can no longer pray, and soon he will no longer be able to love. Truth and goodness must be seen to be attractive, and the way things attract us is because they're beautiful. And that's the truth of the matter. And it is, and I say this in all seriousness, having been a priest for over 50 years and having been thinking about this since about 65, that's the truth of the matter. And it is your glorious privilege as musicians to take up what is often the cross, to take up the struggle, to assume the great responsibility, but to do your best to vindicate the truth that beauty matters, because it's the only way we're going to attract people to living the faith in holiness and in truth. Amir, just. Thank you very much.